It's time for a healthy breakfast.
Which is the number one chocolate
drink. Two pizzas for the price of one.
A taste so wonderfully fresh.
That's a spicy meat.
If you go online and Google golden rice murder, you'll come up with lots of hits.
Hits at these raw spots in our conversation around food.
That raises a broader point about these sort of silver bullet technologies.
Is that as good as it gets for GM crops, or Do you see other cases in which genetically modified crops might actually be a good thing?
Thanks for joining us for The Secret Ingredient, a podcast produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas, that takes you into the depths of food history and production. We won't tell you what to eat, but we can tell you why you're eating it. For KUT, I'm Rebecca McEnroy.
I'm Raj Patel from the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs.
And I'm Tom Philpott from Mother Jones Magazine.
Today's secret ingredient is golden rice. No, it isn't some sort of sexually deviant rice. It is rice that, why don't we ask our guest today, Professor Glenn Davis Stone. He is a professor of anthropology and environmental studies at Washington University in St. Louis. And Glenn, why don't you tell us what is golden rice and why is it so important?
Well, golden rice is a technology that was developed in the 1990s to try to make the endosperm of rice, which is the white part of the grain that people usually eat, contain beta carotene, which is a compound that the human body can turn into vitamin A. And the basic idea behind it was that vitamin A deficiency is one of many nutritional problems in the global south in developing countries. And so the basic idea was that if they could get vitamin A into the endosperm of rice, which is eaten by basically more poor people than any other major food, that it might mitigate this problem.
Well, so does it?
No.
You've been listening to The Secret Ingredient.
Hope you've enjoyed the show.
So Glenn, I was reading a paper, this 2014 paper by a Berkeley economist named David Zilberman, where
yes.
he announces very early in the paper that golden rice has been ready, as he puts it, or available since 2000, but he claims that no country has accepted it, has green-lighted it. And as a result of that, in India alone, so just in one, you know, very large country alone, 1.4 million life years have been lost because of vitamin A deficiency that could have been solved by golden rice. What do you make of that? Is there any truth to that?
Well, there are several problems with that. The first one is that the claim that golden rice has been ready for a long time is simply inaccurate. And golden rice is an interesting project to try to perfect, but they have been working on it for a long time now and have yet to get it to the place where they can release it, that is to where it's actually working properly. So that claim is false. The idea that you can measure how many life years are lost, or what they call them DALYs, which is disability adjusted life year. A DALY basically is one lost year of healthy life. And the problem with trying to estimate how many DALYs have been lost by golden rice not being around is that we don't even know yet what sort of impact golden rice will have on the target audience, which is undernourished kids. We don't even know if it will have any effect on them. Now, it might, and there are a lot of critics out there who would claim that we're sure that this stuff won't have any positive health benefit, and we don't actually know that. But at the same time, the people, and Zilberman is only one of many people who make this claim, the claim that we can assume that this would have a positive impact on kids' health, it just hasn't been demonstrated. So that's a huge assumption.
Yeah, and the fact that something that, you know, isn't field ready yet, and we can talk about that a little bit more, like what's holding it back from being field ready, but something that isn't field ready yet is already being declared to have cost 1.4 million life years, or another prominent academic, University of Texas's Sir Richard Roberts, went so far as to accuse people opposing golden rice as having committed a crime against humanity because it's not out yet. That seems like very heightened rhetoric for something that hasn't been released yet because it's not ready. What is going on there? Why all this heightened rhetoric like that?
That claim is actually pretty common. I first heard Ingo Petraikas, who is the molecular biologist who was the most important person in the development of this technology. I first heard Ingo make that claim in 2000 at a conference, and he said that people who are opposing golden rice are basically guilty of murder. And if you go online and Google golden rice murder, you'll come up with lots of hits where people are pretty frequently hear the charge that people who oppose this are guilty of murder and sometimes are mass murder. And so there are a lot of problems with that. I mean, and the first one just has to do with the nutritional aspect of it, that we don't actually know if golden rice will work.
I thought that in a perhaps ethically not 100% cleared trial, that the golden rice had in fact been field tested in China already, and it appears as if you're willing to waive some of the prior informed consent objections that might emerge from that, there does seem to be evidence that golden rice works.
It works in kids who are given a balanced diet with lipids in it, which is exactly what happened in that study. The study you're referring to was by Tang et al., and it came out in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition in 2012. And you're quite right. They had kids in China that were given golden rice and a series of controls as well to see if the beta carotene in the golden rice was actually turned into vitamin A in the kids. The study was retracted for reasons that had to do with a lack of informed consent, that they basically didn't make it clear to the kids and their parents that they were eating a genetically modified rice. That's not my problem with the study. My problem with the study is this. Vitamin A is a fat-soluble vitamin. The body has to have a certain amount of fat in it in order to convert beta-carotene into vitamin A. And so the target for golden rice are some of the most malnourished kids in the world. And so they're not getting lots of nutrients. They're not getting fats. They're not getting protein. They're not getting vitamin A. And so the scientific question is, can kids like that who are really undernourished and who have lipid poor diets, can they convert beta carotene as it comes in the rice into vitamin A? And we didn't answer that question in this study because in this study, all of the kids in it were given a well-balanced breakfast and lunch that had around 20% of the calories coming from fats. Really, the only question that the study answered was, does golden rice work in kids who don't need it?
And I think, you know, that raises a broader point about these sort of silver bullet technologies. Like, vitamin A deficiency does not work in a vacuum. There's no one on Earth, probably, who has vitamin A deficiency, and then everything else is fine with them. And I also want to talk about the problems, the agricultural problems. And I think one of the things that happens in these conversations is because so many people are so far removed from agriculture, it seems like when you create this sort of miracle rice that maybe people can convert into vitamin A if they get enough fat, it seems like that's a done deal. But the stuff has to be grown out in a field by farmers, and getting it to be able to grow by farmers in real world situations is a whole different problem. And can you talk about that and how that's going with golden rice?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky part of it. I mean, in order to make golden rice, you can think of it this way. There are two parts to it. One of them is the molecular biology and the other is the agronomy or the breeding. The molecular biology part is where you try to find out which genes might make the rice express beta carotene and get them put together into a little molecular package that can be inserted into the rice. After you get the little molecular package to where it's working, you then have to get it into a kind of rice that will actually grow in the place where it's needed. So when they were actually doing the molecular biology, they were using kinds of rice that were sort of like lab rats, sort of like the rice equivalent of a lab rat. They weren't using the rice that people actually want to grow in Bangladesh or the Philippines, but they were using other types that were easy for them to work on. When they finally got the molecular biology working, it was in this kind of rice called K-bonnet, which was not the kind of rice that people wanted to grow in developing countries. So they sent the K-bonnet rice containing this golden rice trait off to the Philippines, where they started the process of trying to breed it into the kinds of rice that farmers actually grow in the Philippines. And so they got the rice back in 2001 and started this arduous process of trying to use conventional breeding and also something called marker-assisted breeding. But basically, it's breeding crops to try to get that trait into a kind of rice that the farmers would actually grow. And it's been very frustrating for them. And these are, by the way, probably the best rice breeders in the world. This is being done at in this research center south of Manila called IRI, which is the International Rice Research Institute. And it's an extraordinary collection of talent in terms of the biology and breeding and ecology of rice. But it's just been a tough nut to crack. And they've gotten it to the point now where it is in some varieties of rice that farmers would grow in the Philippines, but it's still not yielding as much as those varieties yield without the golden rice trait in it. So it's got what's called a yield drag.
And that is, I mean, that's a pretty common thing. Like when you sort of engineer by whatever means a plant to do a particular thing, there's some trade-off to it, right? There's some other thing is going to be different. And it could result in something like, if the plant's energy is going to producing beta carotene, maybe it has less energy to grow or less energy to fend off disease. And that's sort of what's happening here.
Well, maybe. I mean, you're quite right. That's one thing that happens in breeding. It's not entirely clear why the rice isn't yielding as much as it should. But it seems that the most likely explanation is that you know, when you do the molecular biology part of this, you basically put the genes together that you hope will do whatever you want the plant to do, like in this case, make beta carotene, and you insert that into the chromosomes of the target plant. And you don't really have any control over where the genes go. And they might land in a place where they don't work at all. They might land in a place where they work just fine. Or they might land in a place where they seem to work pretty well, but there might be a slight problem with them. And what probably has happened here is in the kind of golden rice that they're working with right now, the genes for producing the beta carotene, they landed in the middle of a gene. And it is it's very likely disrupting the way that gene functions. And the gene happens to have to do with root development. So it's not entirely clear why the golden rice isn't working all that well agronomically, but it seems that at this point in time, the most likely explanation is that the golden rice genes happen to be plopped down right in the middle of a gene that works on root development.
Now, is it possible that, I mean, we hear all this rhetoric about how people are murderers and monsters for opposing it. Is it possible that these plant breeders at Erie are the real monsters because they haven't figured out how to make it work?
I wouldn't call them monsters. I mean, I actually do some work with the folks at Erie, and I've got a very high opinion of them. And furthermore, I mean, their whole approach to this has been quite different than the people who are running around talking about murderers and so on. The Erie people have been good scientists, and they've also been pretty transparent about what's going on with the project. So you can see over and over again people giving talks and on websites claiming that golden rice opponents are murderers. But if you look on Erie's own website, you'll find a much more straightforward account of things. And in fact, on Erie's own website, they make it clear that the rice is just not yielding well enough. And furthermore, they make it clear that as far as they're concerned, they don't know if it actually turns into vitamin A in kids' bodies. And it says right on the Erie website, this rice will not be released until we find out that it actually works in kids. So the Erie people they're good scientists, they're good breeders, and they're also pretty transparent. So what they're trying to do here is something that is extremely hard to do. And so the narrative that you hear that genetically modified crops it's a technology in which scientists can isolate the trait they want, put it into a crop, and have it go out there and work, is grossly oversimplified. It can be devilishly hard to do both the molecular biology and the agronomy. So my hat's off to the people at Erie, and I think people that that want to get a sense of where the status of the of golden rice is should actually look at Erie's own website, because they're the main institution that's carrying the ball on this.
Glenn, I'd like to ask you kind of the impression I get from this conversation and the conversation around golden rice is that it hits at these raw spots in our conversation around food. They want scientists to tell them, are genetically modified foods good for us or bad for us? They want a concise answer to that in a lot of respects. And I wonder if you could kind of put the conversation around golden rice into a narrative around how people, especially in, you know, the West and in the U.S., are coming to terms with their position on genetically modified foods and why this drives such a wedge into the complexity of those discussions.
Yeah, I mean, golden rice has got a really interesting history in terms of the role it's played in these discussions. And part of this has to do with timing. I mean, genetically modified crops were first introduced in the U.S. in the mid-90s, in 94 and 95. And there was some concern, but there wasn't any significant backlash or resistance. And then in 96, they started going into Europe, and they encountered surprising resistance in the UK and France and Germany. And by 97, the resistance had really grown. And by 98, a lot of the stores were pulling all the foods off their shelves that had GM ingredients in them. And so the biotech industry realized by about 98, 99, that they had a real problem on their hands that they hadn't anticipated. And by 99, you can see that their media starts to change, and they begin to really emphasize that what GM crops are best for are for helping people in developing countries and helping the poor and helping the hungry. I think that what they were doing is they were looking for a new narrative. They didn't really need to have a narrative in the U.S. because the crops were accepted pretty much without resistance. But when they ran into this headwind in Europe, they turned to this narrative that these crops are really a humanitarian invention. And golden rice happened to come along just exactly at the right time. So it's in 1999, they got the golden rice grain to where it was working. It wasn't working well enough that it would really make a big difference in people's health. It wasn't producing a lot of beta carotene yet, but it actually was producing some beta carotene. So that's a big step forward for the science. And so the biotech industry was very happy to seize on golden rice as an example of exactly what it was talking about. And so they managed to get time to put golden rice on the cover. And Monsanto, bless their hearts, sent out a press release in 2000 that convinced many newspapers around the U.S. that they were the ones who had actually developed golden rice. And you can find headlines from late summer of 2000 that say things like, you know, Monsanto develops golden rice, or Monsanto's new product is a lifesaver. So the timing was just quite wonderful for golden rice. And so it ended up playing this starring role from the very beginning, even way before it was even working in terms of the beta carotene, and certainly before it was working agronomically.
Yeah, can you develop that a little bit, the role that Monsanto was playing in this? Like, why did they grab it so quickly?
Well, in order to make a genetically modified crop, you always have to use a lot of different patented technologies. And the scientists, when they're working on these technologies, they can very easily get the owners of the patents, which are usually corporations, to give them an okay, just to go ahead and use their patented technologies as long as they don't commercialize it. So they're quick to allow them to use the genes and the technologies just for research purposes. So Monsanto has got the patent on a little piece of DNA called 35S, which is not actually a gene. It's a piece of DNA that controls how genes work. And it is probably the most valuable single piece of DNA in the whole world of biotechnology. And golden rice people wanted to use 35S. And Monsanto said, sure, go ahead, as they oftentimes do. And then what happens is, if you actually come up with something that's going to be released or that's going to be commercialized, then you have to go back to the patent holder, like Monsanto, and get their permission and work out some sort of a financial arrangement with them. And so when golden rice suddenly became this poster child for the biotech industry, they went to Monsanto, and Monsanto said, yeah, you can go ahead and use, make this golden rice and release it. And even if it's got our 35S DNA in it, and we won't charge you anything for it. So that was their role. They didn't sponsor golden rice. They didn't support it. All they did was to allow the golden rice people to use their chunk of 35S DNA. And then when it got to be a major public relations coup, they said, you can go ahead and release it. And they took enormous amounts of credit for that. And then within a few years, the golden rice scientists had actually taken out 35S and replaced it with another piece of DNA. The golden rice that they're working on now doesn't have 35S in it, doesn't have any of Monsanto's technologies in it. This hasn't really stopped Monsanto from continuing to pat themselves on the back for their role in golden rice, though.
Well, so Glenn, what we're hearing is a story about how actually one of the big problems of golden rice is that farmers would never use it because it just doesn't provide as much yield, doesn't provide as much rice as the rice that farmers are used to growing in the Philippines. But there's a flip to that, which is when you hear about, you know, the idiots in Europe who oppose genetically modified crops, they're often counterposed to the wise people who really do know genetically modified crops and understand them, which is farmers. Farmers are often presented as the people who understand the real value of genetically modified crops, because if farmers didn't buy, I mean, farmers are buying GM crops, you know, in India, for example, where you do a lot of work, farmers seem to be buying genetically modified cotton. And aren't farmers smart? I mean, are you saying that the farmers are dumb for buying GM cotton? And I wonder if some of the work that you've done on farmers and farmers' rationality is absolutely mind-blowing. I wonder if you could perhaps talk us through what's at stake here when we talk about farmers being smart when they choose GM crops.
Yeah, it's amazing, especially in India. People are constantly talking about the wisdom of farmers and the brilliance of farmers and so on. And oftentimes the people who are talking about the brilliance of farmers are people who are connected with the biotech industry, who are delighted that farmers are using genetically modified crops. They're oftentimes the same people that before they were before farmers were planting their genetically modified crops, they were talking about these backward farmers who needed to be taught how to farm and so on. You know, I've been working with farmers for, what, over 30 years now, and I've got great respect for farmers, but I don't think they're any smarter or more stupid than anybody else. There's no intelligence test to get into farming. Some of them manage the problems of farming with enormous skill and intelligence, and some of them don't. I mean, there's no reason why, I don't really know how we could generalize about the intelligence of farmers. But in India, one of the things that we've seen is that it's quite true that when genetically modified cotton, it's called BT cotton, and it contains a gene that's, this is totally different than golden rice. It has got a gene in it that makes the cotton plant produce an insecticide that's oftentimes effective against caterpillars, and caterpillars are a major cotton pest, and so it's promising. So this BT cotton appeared in India in the early 2000s, and it was at a time when Indian cotton farmers were having terrible problems with caterpillars. There were really enormous problems in terms of farm ecology and farm economy, and there was this well-known phenomenon of farmers killing themselves, and more often than not, it was a cotton farmer who was killing himself. And so oftentimes the GM cotton is presented as a great solution to the pest problem, and the farmers who adopt it are presented as geniuses for recognizing that the BT cotton is going to solve their problems. The problem with that is that the way the farmers got into that terrible jam in the early 2000s was the last round of technology they had adopted. In the 1990s, hybrid cottons spread through India like wildfire. They were adopted hand over fist by farmers. And they were very fertilizer intensive, they were water intensive, and especially pesticide intensive. That is, left to their own devices, they had very little resistance against this whole range of cotton pests in India. And so you couldn't plant them at all without applying lots of pesticide. And so farmers during the 90s were adopting hybrid cottons, spraying lots of pesticides on them, and oftentimes making good profits at first. And then they found that after 3 years or 5 years or 7 years, the pests had developed resistance to the pesticides, and they were applying more and more pesticide, and it was working less and less, and they were going more and more into debt. So again, I don't think farmers are especially smart, and they're not especially stupid, but you can't look at farmers who are adopting BT cotton and saying, brilliant, you wouldn't be adopting this if it weren't the best thing for you, when they just spent the last decade adopting things that had gotten them into this terrible jam.
And as far as this, the conversation about golden rice, you know, what is your take? What do you want to see happen? What do you want people to know about this discussion around golden rice?
Well, I actually think golden rice has got at least some promise. And I diverge from a lot of the most strident critics of GM crops who think that everything about it is wrong, and Vandana Shiva claims it's a cruel hoax and so on and so forth. I actually think it's got some promise. And I wrote an article back in 2002 called Both Sides Now, where I tried to criticize both sides in the biotech debates. And one of my criticisms was that a lot of the GM critics are unwilling to recognize that there's even any potential for GM crops to help people in the global south. And I wrote in 2002 that golden rice actually has got some promise, and we probably ought to keep an open mind about it and see if it leads somewhere that may end up, you know, making a positive contribution to public health. So that was back in 2002, and it's now 2015, and I think it's fair to say we've given it a shot. They've been working on golden rice since, well, the idea actually was born in 1984, and the Rockefeller program that led to its development started in 1985. So we're many decades into this project, and we find that in the first place, an enormous amount of money has been spent on it, and we find that we don't actually know yet that it works nutritionally, and we find that it's not working yet agronomically, and is probably several years away from that. And so it's been a very slow, very expensive, somewhat promising technology. I think it's also had another unfortunate effect that has to do with public understanding and knowledge. Because GM crops are they're a technology that people really want to know about. They're a technology that people make daily decisions about, like, do you want to buy genetically modified organisms or not? Do you support their being labeled, and so on and so forth? So people want and need to have information about GM crops. And golden rice has played a really crucial role in the spread of misinformation. You hear on a daily basis scientists who are involved in outreach, who really should be helping to educate the public, but end up being just founts of misinformation about golden rice. And in some cases, it's just honest ignorance. When they're talking about how golden rice could be a lifesaver and its opponents are murderers and so on and so forth, maybe they just honestly haven't looked at Erie's own website to find out that Erie doesn't know if it works nutritionally, and Erie doesn't think it works agronomically yet. So maybe it's honest ignorance. In some cases, I think the people know perfectly well what the status of golden rice is, and they're simply lying. But in either case, it's really unfortunate when we have, for instance, academic biologists walking around talking about how this stuff could be a lifesaver, this stuff is ready to go, this stuff is just being held up by Greenpeace and so on and so forth. This technology does have some promise, but those statements are simply wrong. And I think that's it's really doing damage to the public understanding of this technology.
Is that as good as it gets for GM crops, or do you see other cases in which GM crops might, genetically modified crops might actually be a good thing?
Well, I think, you know, if we're talking about people in the global south, there are some crops that are being developed that I continue to think have some promise. And these are crops that I wrote about back in 2002 when I was pointing out that there are some crops that I think GMO critics need to keep an open mind about. One of the ones I've been interested in for a long time is virus-resistant cassava, and there's also virus-resistant, or more generally, disease-resistant banana. And cassava and banana are interesting cases for a molecular biologist because they really do they speak to the needs of the poor more than a lot of other crops. Cassava is an important foodstuff for the poor and big swaths of Africa and also in parts of Asia. Banana in some places, like in East Africa, is the main carbohydrate staple. And cassava and certain kinds of banana really do have major problems with diseases. And in some cases, they're diseases that you can make the crops resistant to by using genetic modification. So I've been very interested in this stuff called Virka, which is virus-resistant cassava for Africa, that they've been working on here in St. Louis for decades. And there's also work going on various kinds of disease-resistant banana in places like Uganda. And I think these crops have got some promise. They're certainly not silver bullets. And they've also got some big question marks sort of attached to them. There's a biological problem that viruses mutate really quickly. So if we do develop a virus-resistant cassava and we release it in Africa and farmers start to plant it, and then the virus mutates, we'll probably have to go back to square one because the virus at that point probably won't be of any use in terms of resisting the virus. So that's always a big question mark hanging over it. But I continue to think that some of these crops, like disease-resistant banana and cassava, have got promise. And as they continue to work on them, I don't have any opposition to that at all. I think in general, the best argument for GM crops is that the ability to move genes around among organisms is just an astonishingly powerful tool. And it has been one of the best things that biology has had happen to it in many decades. It basically allows biologists to learn things about how genes function that they couldn't learn in any other way. So it's been really phenomenal for science. And I think there have been a lot of secondary benefits that have trickled out of basic scientific research that have helped agriculture in general. But in terms of the practical side of it, that is, what do you do with this extraordinary power? That's always the big question.
Glenn, with the hindsight we have, 20 some odd years since the sort of birth of the idea of golden rice, is there any way in which the project can be said to have increased the problem of vitamin A deficiency? And what I mean by that is by sucking in and tying up resources that could have gone to methods of dealing with a problem that we know are effective, diversifying diets, fortifying stuff like you mentioned before, whatever, these other ways that we know would work. Has it sucked up enough resources to have actually, possibly worsened the problem?
Well, I think your point is a good one, that genetic engineering has sucked up a lot of resources. And had it not come along, or had it not played the role it has played, maybe some of those resources would have gone to other kinds of crop development. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I think it also has helped to spread a lack of understanding about problems like vitamin A deficiency. That is, it encourages people to think of this as a very specific nutritional problem that can be solved with a simple technology. And so that covers up the larger questions that vitamin A deficiency is just one of a whole suite of nutritional problems. It really is just an index of poverty. I think it's damaged people's understanding of vitamin A and nutritional problems. And I think it has sucked resources away from other things that might have been done. Whether or not it's actually led to a worsening of vitamin A, I can't say. You know, it's always hard to say, you know, what the world would be like now if things had been different. But I certainly think you've got a good point there about its potentially negative impacts on the direction of other interventions.
All right.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us about it. Thank you so much.
Great. Well, thanks. Thanks for inviting me to do it. It's been a delight.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye. All right. See you later.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Secret Ingredient with Raj Patel, Tom Philpott, and me, Rebecca McEnroy. On our next episode, The Secret Ingredient is quinoa. We'll talk with Tanya Kirsten, author of Grabbing Power, the new struggles for land, food, and democracy in northern Honduras. Also, make sure you never miss an episode. Subscribe to The Secret Ingredient in iTunes or on SoundCloud. Leave us a review. We'd love to hear what you think of the show. The Secret Ingredient is engineered by David Alvarez and produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas.